Welcome back to There Is a Season, the Pete Seeger podcast. Join us as we speak today with author Elijah Wald and learn more about his book, Dylan Goes Electric, and its role in being optioned for the film, A Complete Unknown. In our conversation, Elijah discusses how Seeger and Dylan were represented in the movie and shares a variety of insights on how both Seeger and Dylan have been interpreted, respectively, over the course of history. We conclude by discussing the lasting legacy of both of these artists and how both will be remembered going forward. Well, Elijah Wald, thank you so much for joining us on There Is a Season, the Pete Seeger podcast. It's great to have you here.
Sure. Thanks for having me.
Well, Elijah, I've seen the Dylan film several times now, and being a Pete Seeger fan, I have had a lot to say. I put out an episode giving my two cents. I waited for everyone else to say their things and stood in the back and listened, right? And waited for all that to happen. Then I put my stuff out. But I wanted to begin. I know a bit about you. I grew up outside Boston, and you're from Cambridge. And I know that your brother was involved in the folk scene in the early 60s and knew many people. And you had an introduction to folk music through the place that you were at and through the people you knew, through your family and so forth. So you have your own existential purpose, I guess. You had that for writing this book and for optioning it for the film. But could you tell us what gave you the impetus to write this book specifically? Out of all the books you've written, you then arrived at this subject. And why do you think that was a good subject to be optioned for a Hollywood film?
I mean, honestly, the reason I arrived at it was very simple. It was money. I mean, most of the books I write are not as easy to sell as a Dylan book. And specifically what happened was when the Beatles, I had written a book with the title, How the Beatles Destroyed Rock and Roll. It wasn't actually primarily about the Beatles, but when the 50th anniversary of the Beatles' arrival in the U.S. happened, several reporters called me looking for a different angle. And I thought, hey, 50th anniversaries, huh? And it struck me that the 50th anniversary of Dylan going electric at Newport was coming up in a year and a half. And if I could rush out a book, I could own that moment. And I called my agent and she said, hell yes. And I figured it would pay for 3 years of my life and fund writing books that weren't going to sell that way. And so that was really the impetus. Once I start, and my original idea was that I could do it quick and dirty because there were already a million other books on the subject. But as usual, when I actually started looking into it, a lot of it looked very different than what I had expected and than the received wisdom. And the other thing that happened was my original proposal, I was going to start by sort of giving a background history of the folk scene. And when I started doing that, I realized that instead of doing it that way, I could personify the entire folk scene with Pete Seeger. Mm-hmm. And suddenly it could turn into this story of these two guys, these two men. And honestly, pretty much the only thing the movie took from my book, but obviously very central to the movie, was the idea that this is the story of Dylan and Seeger, which is not how anyone had ever told the Dylan story. Normally it's Dylan and various other people in the village, because in real life, Dylan and Seeger weren't actually in the same rooms very often. Mm-hmm. But, you know, I used Seeger as a personification of the entire folk scene. And I don't know. I mean, the oddity of the book getting optioned is that the person who decided to option it was Dylan, and his people optioned it and then brought everyone else on board. I have no idea why he picked that book, but, you know, given what ended up happening, I have to wonder whether part of it was that he liked the idea of it being him and Pete.
I wonder about that too. But the whole paradigm that you, I think one thing I want to touch on is just the whole paradigm you write with and the story you tell, which is very different than many of the other stories. And I want to ask you in a few minutes about some of the stuff David Hajdu says in his book, which is very different than I think how you think about things and frame things. But I think that over the past 25 years, you've written all these books about all these topics in so-called American folk and roots music, whatever this genre is. And the book on Josh White, which is probably one of your favorites, I'm assuming, and the Johnson
Well, it
book.
was the first, so I have a certain affection for it. And incidentally, Pete wrote me a really lovely note when it came out, which was also nice.
Right. And when Pete said that he learned things about Josh White that he didn't know, that must have meant something to you to see something like that.
Well, I mean, the thing that really mattered from him was him saying that it was a fairer book than he had imagined possible. You know, I mean, Pete had had very mixed feelings about what Josh did in the McCarthy era, and had realized that he had wrestled with that. I mean, as you know, I'm sure, as someone doing a regular Pete Seeger thing, Pete was given to wrestling with himself, and Josh was definitely one of the subjects that he'd done soul searching around. But in any case, yeah, I mean, he gave me a lovely interview for that. And I was very pleased with his reaction.
I mean, there's all that this stuff that's come out since about Josh White might have been extorted into giving that testimony because of relationships he had with people, and I don't know if that's true or not.
It's possible, but I mean, you didn't have to extort somebody to make them decide that they didn't want to give up their entire livelihood. I mean, both Toshi and Lee Hayes took Pete aside and said, basically, you're a white guy from a well-to-do family. And you don't have four children. You have no idea of the pressures that Josh is under. And I think that was accurate. I mean, Jackie Robinson did roughly the same thing that Josh did. Langston Hughes did something very similar to what Josh did. It was not. The other thing is people didn't understand that Josh was not asked to name names. He was just asked to distance himself from Paul Robeson, as were Jackie Washington and Langston Hughes. I mean, the pressures on one hand were much heavier on them, and from the committee were in some ways lighter on them. In any case, yeah.
Well, I think much of your work follows this attempt to, in hindsight, many decades later, to interrupt or, try to expose the co-optation of some of these discourses and these stories about these figures and about these moments in American cultural history. And I think How the Beatles Destroyed Rock and Roll is maybe the quintessential example of you doing this, but I feel like Dylan Goes Electric has a similar epistemology to it. And
Well, I
is that an
mean,
accurate reading?
honestly, the way my work is often framed is that I'm critical of other people's work. What I tend to frame it as it's different. I'm different. I mean, it's not that I think there's a problem with the received wisdom. It's that when a story is always told the same way, it's interesting to take another look at it and see if there's another way to tell it. I'm not claiming my way is better, necessarily. In some cases, yes, I think the received wisdom is simply wrong, but in many cases, I think the received wisdom is equally right. But, in the specific case of Dylan and Seeger at Newport, I mean, over and over and over, that story was told in terms of Dylan was doing brilliant forward-looking work, and the stupid folkies didn't get it. And that is not entirely wrong, but it's one side of a profoundly two-sided situation, which as you suggested, I came with a certain understanding, having grown up on the folk scene. But also just around a lot of people who, my aim with that book by the time it stopped being just to have a project that would sell a lot of books and pay for my next 3 years of life. My philosophical aim, you might say, with that book was to write it so that by the time that moment came at Newport, the reader wouldn't know whether they would have been cheering or booing.
Right. Well, I've heard you when you gave those book talks 10 years ago when the book came out, and I've watched some of these. You talked about, and you mentioned a few minutes ago when you were getting into this and you thought, well, there's all this written, it'll be easy to do, but then you discover new things that you came across that you didn't necessarily expect, which is, theoretically how the research process is supposed to go. We don't know how it's going to
Always.
go.
Yeah.
And but you went down, it led you to going down certain rabbit holes. And maybe you could share with us, like, what were those pieces that you came across that you did not expect that helped shape the narrative that you told?
Well, one of the huge ones, I didn't do a lot of interviews for the books. I didn't have a lot of time. And also, when you're talking about an event that happened 50 years ago, a lot of people had been interviewed much closer to the date. And I would rather see, what Pete Seeger said about Pete Seeger's a perfect example. I mean, Pete Seeger by the late 1970s had completely revised his memory of what happened that night. So I wanted to find out what he'd said at the time. But one of the people I did interview was Peter Stampfl from the Holy Modal Rounders, who actually, one of the interesting things was that Stampfl and Jim Kweskin and Dylan were briefly a trio, which I had no idea of. But Stampfl was the one, Stampfl said that when he saw Dylan within a week or 2 weeks of Dylan arriving in the village. And it was life-changing for him because his loves had been R&B music and hillbilly music, his terminology. But he'd always thought of them as two completely separate things. And when he saw Dylan was playing hillbilly songs like they were rock and roll, and that changed his life. And my immediate reaction was, "What are you talking about? Dylan's folky stuff didn't sound like rock and roll." And then I went back to that first album and was listening to it. And there he is on Highway 51 playing the lick from the Everly Brothers' Wake Up Little Susie. And I go, wow, I've discovered something. And then I read the liner notes, which I had read a million times. And it's referred to as the Everly Brothers flavored Highway 61. And the liner notes refer to Carl Perkins and early Elvis Presley among his influences. And it was suddenly like, wait a minute, he got signed to Columbia Records as sort of the rock and roller on the folk scene back in 1961. And they promptly, of course, followed up with the electric single Mixed Up Confusion. And the whole idea that he was the folky guy who went electric later, basically, that. I had fallen for that like everyone else, because like everyone else, I had heard Dylan backwards. We all, whichever album we started with, virtually all of us went back to the first album after we had heard The Times They Are A-Changin' and Freewheelin'.
Many of us
I mean,
probably,
I.
and speaking for myself, I think the first I heard was The Essential Dylan when I was like 13.
Okay.
And the first
Yeah.
track on The Essential Dylan is Blowin' in the Wind.
But I mean, I routine, but Blowing in the Wind is the first track because of Peter, Paul, and Mary. And so, we all thought of him originally as that guy who's got a weird voice, but basically sings that soft, folky stuff like Peter, Paul, and Mary, only with a weirder voice and bluesier sound, and I liked him a lot better. But again, that's because we were going backwards from where he went later. And that first album is much more rock and roll.
Well, do you think John Hammond saw Dylan not purely as a folk musician when he first encountered him? Did he think of him more as a rock and roller?
I don't think Hammond exactly framed it that way, but he definitely heard an energy there that was distinctive. I mean, there were lots of other people he could have pulled out of the folk scene, and he didn't. And Hammond was someone who his history had mostly been with black music, had mostly been with blues and jazz. I mean, Hammond was not given to loving folk stuff. So, and the next person who came up, Tom, come on, what's his name? Dylan's producer, the black guy, who had released Cecil Taylor and Sun Ra on his own label. Oh God, I'm sorry. In any case, Dylan's next producer after Hammond was, as I say, a black Harvard graduated jazz fan whose comment on Dylan was that he could sing blues without sounding affected, and if we got the right backing behind him, we could have us a white Ray Charles. I mean, there were a lot of people who heard that in Dylan, rather than hearing him as the guy who writes the songs for Peter, Paul, and Mary. But most of us got him as the guy who writes the songs for Peter, Paul, and Mary, and for Pete Seeger, who, of course, was doing Dylan songs very early. And Pete very much did see him as the heir to Woody Guthrie, who for Pete, and this is something actually that I'd underline. It's not just about the writing. And that's, when the other thing I realized reasonably early in the book is that pretty much all Dylan books treat him as a songwriter. But the choice to go electric at Newport, which is the story I was telling, is not about songwriting. That's about who he was as a musician and performer. And likewise, the thing with Woody Guthrie, what Pete loved about Woody Guthrie was not primarily the songwriting. I mean, when Pete wrote his earlier essay on Woody Guthrie for Sing Out, the thing he stressed was Woody's singing. I mean, Pete thought Woody Guthrie was the greatest singer he had ever heard. And Woody was also a great guitar player, great harmonica player. And I think when Pete heard Dylan as another Woody Guthrie, he was hearing all those pieces. He was hearing the singing, the guitar playing, the harmonica playing, the blues influence, which both of them had very strongly and which Pete never was able to really get. I mean, Pete could play really interesting blues banjo, but as a singer, he had no ability to sing blues and he knew it. Whereas Dylan and Guthrie were exceptionally credible blues singers for white guys. They were in a class with Jack Elliott and Johnny Cash and Jimmie Rodgers.
That's interesting to hear. I mean, Pete, of course, is one of the few banjo players that does as much blues on the banjo as any banjo player does. I mean, there are other blues banjo players out there, five-string banjo players, but
No,
Pete.
as a banjo player, absolutely. And as a guitar player, I mean, he wrote the book on Lead Belly's guitar style with Julius Lester. But as a singer, he had no ability to sing blues, and he was acutely conscious of that. He heard blues, he compared it to flamenco. And his position on both blues and flamenco was that he heard an anger in that music that he didn't have, that he didn't feel. I mean, Pete was an astonishingly good judge of his own skills. I mean, there's that wonderful review he wrote, career retrospective review he wrote in Sing Out of himself, but unsigned, that only later he copped to, in which I think he makes a very, very accurate assessment of his strengths and weaknesses. And, I mean, I don't know how you feel about this, but Pete is, I think, a difficult character to introduce younger listeners to, because what was great about him isn't on the records. I mean, Dylan, any not, you know, most of the great artists, musical artists, you can hear on the records the thing that's compelling about them. But Pete was a live act. I
Oh,
mean, the
I agree.
records give no hint of what he that it was like to see that man on stage.
No, and Pete was, of course, more than acutely aware of that and spoke about it. Like,
Yeah.
I grew up listening to many of the records. Many of the live ones have only come out in the last 15 years. Live in 65 in Pittsburgh, which is an incredible performance, I think. And then the Newport 65 stuff, that workshop where the seagulls are flying around, where he's talking about banjo styles, like that has not been available to the public accessibly until maybe 15 or 20 years ago. So those things I didn't hear when I was young. What I heard was Pete Seeger's greatest hits, and I heard American favorite ballads. I heard American industrial ballads. So I love all of that stuff. But of course, it's just Pete and Mo Ash's little booth churning out stuff, you know, as much as he can. And but I value that wholeheartedly, because he just shared so many songs with people. So people picked up a lot from those in the 50s and early 60s that Mo Ash was releasing. So I
Oh, and
think.
I mean, his Darling Corey album. I mean, nobody, not nobody, but virtually nobody gives that album the credit it deserves. I mean, Tom Paley, you know, the New Law City Ramblers, all the credit they're given for having sort of gone against the Weavers, Seeger sort of thing. And actually tried to play that stuff like it was played by the originals down south. Paley's immediate reaction when I suggested that to him was, well, Pete did that on the Darling Corey album. That was the beginning of that. I mean, that album started the real roots folk revival. I mean, all the credit people give to the Harry Smith anthology, including specifically that Dylan would have got down on Penny's Farm, which he turned into Maggie's Farm from the Harry Smith anthology. I'm sorry, Pete had already recorded that one on the Darling Corey album. No, Pete was, and I mean, Pete was an astoundingly good musician. I mean, the Goofing Off Suite, that version he does of Blue Skies, is just an astonishing piece of work. All of which said, and I had a big stack of Pete Seeger albums. I mean, I can't even tell you what the first two I had were because by my earliest memories, I already had 5 or 8 or 10. I was a huge fan, but I had seen him live. And no matter how much one may like the albums, including the live albums, it's nothing compared to the experience of seeing him in a room. And quite frankly, a lot of the live albums, you know, that moment you say with Newport with the seagulls, it can sound pretty goddamn hokey if you weren't there watching the man. If you were, it was magic.
And Pete, you know, would want to sing harmony. So if, and this is the whole thing. He wanted to have a group of people singing so that he could sing the lines that he wanted to sing on the songs that he enjoyed singing. Of course, he wanted to get people singing. He had his sociopolitical ambitions through, you know, cultural work like the music he was doing. But, you know, David Dunaway in his biography talks about Pete in boarding school getting, you know, told off for singing harmony in the back of the choir and stuff like that. But that's what he would prefer to do. He wanted his place to lead a group, but he still wants to do his thing at the same time. And with Dylan's songs, he does still do a lot of like just performance. There's so much in his live performances, which is still just him playing when the audience isn't singing along, right?
Oh yeah. Yeah, no, I mean and he would also just be quietly playing a wooden flute. I mean, his performances were all sorts of things. And the singing along part, the song leader part, was what he was perhaps uniquely brilliant at. But it wasn't like he did whole concerts of that. And it wasn't like that was what was magical about his concerts. What was magical about his concerts was the incredible range of stuff that he was able to do. And, and as he himself emphasized, it wasn't that he did it all that well. It was the sum total. There's he's one of those artists who there is nothing you no single song or even single five or six songs you could put up and say this is what Pete Seeger does. Every concert he gave was just immensely varied, and the brilliance was the totality.
Well, I want to ask you about the film a little bit more.
Yeah,
And
sure.
I believe that after you saw one of the early screenings in Boston, you put up something on Facebook where you said, and I quote, "I'm shocked and I liked it," unquote. Can you explain a little bit more about what you meant by that?
Oh, I mean, that's been the standard reaction of everyone I know who was deep on the scene. I mean, all of us went, even the people who love it and the people who don't love it, everyone was surprised at how much better it was than they expected. First of all, how well the music was done, which was, I think, astonishing. Secondly, obviously, for this podcast, Ed Norton is uncanny. I mean, I got emails from people like Ron Radosh, who, actually used to go and visit Pete, up the Hudson. I mean, it is an uncanny capturing of Seeger. I mean, just amazing. But just the capturing of the time and the feel of the place and the people. Aside from which, it just is a very fast-moving movie. I mean, it's 2 hours, 20 minutes. It feels like an hour and a half. I mean, it's a very well-made piece of entertainment. But it also is remarkably true to the time and place and the people in ways that I think none of us expected. I mean, I have quibbles. There were little things that bothered me, but perfect example of something, the scene on Rainbow Quest with Morganfield, Big Bill Morganfield. I mean, I think there is a stereotyped and frankly racist portrayal of the old blues guy drinking his whiskey on the set, which, I mean, I'm sorry, those guys were professionals. They may have drunk whiskey before and after, but they knew you don't drink during. But that said, as you were saying a minute ago, I was when I first saw the film, I was expecting that scene to go, Peter seems sort of discomfited by the old blues guy in the film. Dylan arrives. He and the old blues guy sort of start bonding, and I expected that to be a moment of break. But instead, what they do is Dylan and the old blues guy start playing a blues, and God damn it, Norton picks up a banjo and starts playing exactly the way Pete used to play when he jammed on a blues. That very effective blues banjo playing. And that sort of thing was, for me, completely unexpected that they'd get that right. And have, once they start playing a blues, Pete join in and play very effective blues. I mean, just the level of understanding of the music, and the relationships. I, like a lot of other people, were completely startled by how much of that they got right.
Yeah, if there was one scene that irked me, it was that. And I saw that, like, it's trying to demonstrate Pete's versatility and his ability and the nuance of the music that he's able to appreciate and support. I get that, but I wonder if that scene was really necessary to be able to show that they have to do all those other things like this guy's from the Delta, you know, this very Joseph Conrad understanding of like deep in the South, somewhere down there, you know, and he emerges and he's this guy that can play this way. They really need to do something like that to make that point.
I think it was good having the blues player on there. I would have liked him to be less stereotyped.
Yeah.
I mean, I do think one of the things that Pete did on Rainbow Quest was give space to a lot of those guys, to Gary Davis, to Mississippi John Hurt, to Elizabeth Cott. You know, I do think that was one of Pete's real strengths, that he did not accept the divisions. You know, I mean, and it was, of course, also political for him. But, you know, it was not a minor part of Pete's character that he was teaming up with Willie Dixon and Memphis Slim at the Village Gate, which was, I mean, that's an interesting move, because most people on the folk scene who went to blues, they wanted those guys to be guitar players and harmonica players. I mean, the folk audience was a lot more ready to take Sonny Terry and Brownie McGee than Memphis Slim and Willie Dixon. But Pete, I mean, there were some early things that he did with Sonny and Brownie, but by 64, 65, Pete was, who Pete wanted to be playing with was Memphis Slim and Willie Dixon. I mean, that's so, yeah, I was pleased that there was that straight up blues there, but I didn't like the way the character was portrayed.
Yeah. No, that live at the Village Gate with Memphis Slim and Willie Dixon is perhaps my favorite live Seeger record. I think it's really innovative, and no one else was doing anything quite like that. And Pete's banjo playing on like Leadbelly's song New York City, I think is phenomenal. I think it's really exciting. So I wish we could have seen a little bit more of that kind of cross-pollination. They do show Sonny and Terry. And Brownie McGee in that scene at the Hootenanny. So there is some
Yeah.
acknowledgement of it.
No, I mean, you know, as I say, I am much more struck by what they got right than the things they got wrong. And I'm absolutely not on the list of, I wish they'd have had more of X. I mean, you know, more Van Ronk, more Ramblin' Jack Elliott. But, you know, by the time we're done with the list, we have a mini series, not a movie.
Of course. Well, one piece that of the story that stuck out to me, and yes, you can't include all these people here, and then the Phil Oakes people are really furious, and that's a whole discourse in and of itself, which I don't need to go down that road. But I feel like an important part of the story musically was the musical relationship between Joan and Bob, and I really felt like that's an important part of this, and Joan is treated in such a way. I was disappointed, and not by the performance, not by the acting, not by the music, none of it, but by the writing of her character. You know, that musical relationship where Joan discovers what Bob is capable of. And David Hajdu talks about this in his book when, you know, Joan says, "When I heard him say God on our side, I took him seriously. I was bowled over. It's a beautiful song. I didn't think anything could come out of that little toad," is what Joan apparently said. And that
Yeah.
influence, I don't know if that's there.
To be, if we're going to go that route, the people who should be complaining are Peter, Paul, and Mary, who in fact put Dylan's songs on, you know, who in fact brought Dylan's songs to the world and who've been written out of the story. And Joan Baez is treated as the character who discovered Blowing in the Wind and brought it to the world. I mean, if anything in that sense, she's over stressed in the movie as the person who's the star who brings Dylan to the world, when in fact that was Peter, Paul, and Mary. Again, they made an effective film. They played with history a lot in order to do that. By and large, if instead of talking about what's left out, we talk about what's put in, you know, as with Baez, I mean, they do not make her a patsy for Dylan, which a lot of the Dylan fans like to do. They have her standing up for herself and calling him an asshole.
Right.
I understand why all the various camps are upset that their person isn't given more space. I'm just not playing that game. I mean, there's so many people who expect me to stand up for Van Ron. And it's like, no, Dave wouldn't have complained about that. That wasn't what the, you know, that wasn't the movie.
Right. And in one of your interviews, you said that Van Ronk would have loved the whole thing. And you said.
I don't think I quite said that. I think he would have enjoyed it by and large. I mean, he certainly, on his list of complaints, him not having a bigger role would not have been one of them. I mean, I'm sure he would have had his list of complaints, and I'm not sure what they would have been, but I'm sure that wouldn't have been one of them.
I want to talk about just the scene in Greenwich Village in the early 60s. And just to talk about Haidu's book a little bit more, he makes an interesting statement.
Sure.
He says something interesting about that there were two camps of people, that there were the Seeger followers and the Guthrie followers. And I don't know how binary, first of all, that was. And, he talks about like Where Have All the Flowers Gone was written by a guy whose hair was going gray, and Woody Guthrie wrote This Land Is Your Land, and he was dying, and saying that these people were ossifying and that they didn't really have revolutionary ideas, which I feel like is not an accurate reading of people's songs. It's not an accurate reading of the Almanac Singers, the history of that. Like to say that these guys weren't revolutionary for their time and didn't have that kind of influence, I don't know how accurate that is.
I honestly don't remember that part of Haidu's book, and I'm not going to argue with it without reading it. I mean, there were, you know, I had some problems with that book, but honestly, my problems were very different. My problems were I read it on the train coming back from New York to Boston, and went home and put on a Richard and Mimi Farina album to see whether it in fact sounded way the hell better than I remembered, and it didn't. I mean, they were good, but the idea that they were in a class with Dylan and Baez, I think, is wrong. Certainly Farina, the idea that Farina as a writer was in Dylan's class, I think is absurd. I mean, Farina was a brilliant hustler, but you know, Dylan changed the world. Whether one likes the way he changed it or not, Dylan changed the world.
Well, I mean, I feel like it was the generational piece, what that seemed to be the catalyst, the myth of Seeger and the myth of Guthrie and how it circulated, the mediums through which it passed, that had a profound impact on people to discover the music they did and to write the music that they did at the time. A lot of it was just based on like Seeger and Guthrie rode freight trains and they did this and that, and the raw imagination of all of that seemed
Well,
to be on
I
people's
mean,
minds.
I think the riding freight trains part was very much Guthrie, not Seeger. I mean, Seeger was always around and accessible. I think to the extent Pete Seeger was a mythic character, it was for standing up to the McCarthyites. I don't think anybody really thought of him as Hobo Pete. Everybody understood that he had gone that way with Guthrie. But I mean, Ramblin' Jack Elliott, for example, was much more of a Guthrie type character. I mean, I think something that a lot of people misunderstand, because again, you know, we get everything in, you know, we come to these things in hindsight. Most people came to Guthrie through Dylan. I'm probably one of the youngest people on the planet who was a Guthrie fan before I first heard Dylan. There are very few of us still alive. And For the thing that I also have that I think I share with Dylan, this is probably the only sentence on earth I would say that I share with Dylan, is that it's people who came to this all later through Dylan think of Guthrie as a songwriter and even secondarily think of Guthrie as a musician and singer. But the thing that was really thrilling about Guthrie for me, and I'm absolutely certain for Dylan, was the character in Bound for Glory. I mean, Guthrie invented this mythic character for himself in that book that was for us something beyond anything that any, you know, it was. That was not who Pete Seeger was. I mean, Pete's, there was a wildness to Guthrie that, you know, Ramblin' Jack Elliott, I think, captured that. Dylan came into New York pretending he was that guy. I mean, he was, it's not true that Dylan came to New York sounding like Woody Guthrie. He came to New York sounding like Ramblin' Jack Elliott and doing a lot of blues, but he came to New York being Woody Guthrie, the character in Bound for Glory. And Pete was definitely the conduit for a lot of Guthrie's music for all of us. But the Guthrie myth was in Guthrie's own book, and Pete never attempted to grab a piece of that. Pete was always very clear that he was the educated college boy who made one trip west with Woody. But, you know, Pete was, by the time we first hear of Pete was already the married family man living around New York.
Right, and I think in terms of popular discourse, although in the in terms of authenticity, I don't think Pete ever tried to claim Guthrie at all. That's totally accurate. But you know, Pete went out on his own after Woody showed him the ropes, and he traveled independently the time he broke his banjo and all of that. And then
For
the
15 minutes, come on.
yeah, and the CIO tour he did with Woody. I mean, you know, in 1941 with the Almanac Singers, the other people dropped out and he keeps going with Woody. It's no comparison to Woody. But I just get the, and I don't have a discourse analysis of this, but people must have talked about these stories.
I mean, I think it's very, very easy to forget that for virtually everybody, the primary association with Pete Seeger, free the Dylan moment, is that he is the Weavers in Goodnight Irene. He was the absolute king of that New York pop folk thing. I mean, he was much more the father of Peter, Paul, and Mary than he was the brother of Woody Guthrie. I mean, the Weavers was still his primary, the primary point of reference for Pete Seeger as of 1960, 61, 62, is still the guy from the Weavers.
Well, in the book, you retell the events of the performance of Maggie's Farm and the electric set with a lot of detail. And,
Yeah.
you know, you go
Some
into
people would say too much.
you talk about all these different strange things that happen. I mean, this whole event, just that single set that night at the festival, after reading your description and having known what I knew before, and then having all this added in to the mix, it just to me seems like the whole incident is this bizarre coalescence of several cultural and organizational issues coming to a head. And on the one hand, we can say, well, we'll never really know what exactly was said or what exactly happened or why, because it's been told so many times. That's what a lot of people are saying now. But
Well, on the other hand, it's all on film and on tape.
yes.
So compared to most such disputed incidents, there's an awful lot we can, in fact, say for sure.
Right. In terms of how the film re-represented this event, not to talk about the facts of this, like Judas wasn't said, et cetera, the Grossman fight with Lomax was in the
Yeah,
afternoon.
sure.
Like there's all that stuff. I don't really have a beef necessarily with any of that. But in terms of how the audience of this film walks away with thinking about Pete, what is the film trying to do? What is it trying to say to us about Pete Seeger from that whole interaction?
That's been interesting to me because having talked to a lot of people who've seen the film, what it seems to in fact be is kind of a Rorschach test. I mean, I have talked to lots of people who think that the film makes Seeger look like the bad guy in that moment. And I've talked to lots of people who think that the film did a really good job of making Seeger sympathetic in that situation. I mean, the scene where Seeger, brings them coffee and tries to persuade Dylan. I know people who find that scene really compelling. And I know people who find that scene, Seeger being stuck in an old paradigm and not understanding what's going on. It really seems to be a Rorschach test. And I have to say, to the extent it in fact functions that way, I think they did a really good job because I think it should, I mean, like I said, I want people to come in not being persuaded. I mean, there are things, again, there are little things. Honestly, what in that scene I find strangest is that it portrays the Newport audience as all sitting in chairs when Dylan is doing his electric set, when the fact is that all the young people came rushing toward the front, and there was a screened-off area in the front where the press and the in crowd were. There were people standing and yelling. That's why you can hear them on the tape. And I have no idea why Mangold chose to have everybody staying in their chairs. It would seem to me that it would have been more effective cinematically to have them rushing the stage, yelling and cheering, than to have them all sitting there. But I mean, that's the inaccuracy that strikes me in that scene.
When I saw you at the panel with Bill Hanley back in the winter, and you said
Sure.
something that I wrote down, and I want to quote back what you said. And you said, "As much as I love Pete Seeger, he completely changed his story. A year later, he's saying, 'I didn't understand Maggie's Farm. As the years go on, I love Maggie's Farm,'" is what you said. And
Yeah.
so I had that in mind. And in February, I was down
And
at the
at the time, he actually referred to it as what was the phrase? The most destructive sound
this
he had
side of
ever heard. This
hell.
side of hell. Yes, exactly. The most destructive sound this side of hell. No, I mean he kept modifying his position on that one. I think honestly, because he felt like he had been unfair to Dylan. I don't think he was trying to make himself look good. That was not who Pete was. But I do think he felt like he had been unfair to Dylan, and there were people who were listening to him, and he had to correct that.
Right. I was at the American Folklife Center in February, and I was listening to David Dunaway's interviews he did with Pete in the late 70s, which you have to go there.
Yeah.
You have to go there to hear them. I had the transcripts, but I wanted to hear what Pete sounded like when he was explaining himself, right? Because the tone of voice, not to psychoanalyze Pete, because people have done that enough,
Sure.
but just to hear the data in terms of how it was enunciated. And Dunaway is asking Pete, I heard that people said that you had issues with Grossman, and Pete says, "Me have problems with Al? I don't know why anyone would have said that, you know." And he seems so taken aback by all of these questions, and he said, "Like, well, I," he says the same sort of narrative, like I couldn't hear the words, like. But that's December of 1977. Then in like the early 90s, there's that postcard that he allegedly sent to Bob. That image has circulated around a lot. I think it was at the Bob Dylan Center, the postcard, where he says,
Yeah.
"Bob, exclamation point. I heard that you thought that I didn't like this. I don't want you to think
Right.
that." So there's the whole apology going on. That's in 1993 or something. So he added to it over the years.
Yeah.
But do you think that in hindsight, Pete might have felt like, well, I actually was wrong, or I actually didn't understand what was going on?
Oh, of course. Absolutely. Absolutely. I think Pete absolutely felt like he'd misunderstood that moment. And more than that, I think he felt like what happened was partly his fault. I think he felt like if he had understood that moment, he could have defused it and everything would have been okay.
Because he
I
does make,
think,
go ahead, sorry.
yeah, no, I think that, you know, his reaction that it was just destructive. I don't think he was wrong. I think it certainly ended up that way. I mean, it certainly was the end of something. I mean, George Wein said, you know, from that moment on, we were no longer the center event. You know, we were just a bunch of nice folkies. We were no longer where things were happening. And I think that Pete, and now, you know, I'm projecting, but, you know, we both have spent a lot of time with Pete Seeger one way or another. And he was given to feeling responsible for stuff, and certainly for Newport. And I think as he came to understand that this was Dylan doing work that was not only brilliant art, but in fact was speaking to a generation and a generation's anger and a generation's concerns with songs like Maggie's Farm, that he came to feel like Newport could have been the stage for that if he had understood it. And it could have been the moment of Dylan and Newport taking that next step if he had stepped up and framed it that way. And because he misunderstood it, it had instead become Dylan against Newport.
And Pete said that he made the mistake of not going up to the microphone after saying, like, why are you booing Bob? You didn't boo these other people.
Right. I mean, this is like, you know, Peter Yarrow, who I have, you know, who I do not have the same feelings for that I have for Pete. Peter Yarrow framed it as, you know, if Dylan had gone up there and done that set the other way around, sung a couple of acoustic songs and said, now I'd like you to hear my new stuff, that everybody would have been ready for it. I think that incidentally is right, but I think that Pete had a deeper understanding of the extent, you know, as after calling it the most destructive music this side of hell, he begins wondering, this is in the piece he wrote that week, whether, you know, what pressures had driven Dylan to that, and whether he was himself responsible for having put too much weight on the kid's shoulders. I mean, Pete was given to soul searching. And I think the ways he reframed his memory of that need to be seen in that context. And I think he's right. You know, I think if he had understood where that was going, he could have been part of it rather than a barrier to it. He could have been remembered as part of it rather than a barrier to it, which is how very quickly, you know, he was shortly recording himself with electronic instruments to some extent. But, you know, that's not how it went down.
No, and it's unfortunate that Pete gets remembered this way. I think anyway. And even if he didn't play the music Bob was playing, which I think is beside the point, that people go in these different directions after that point. And then, you know, in contemporary times, we look back like there's Dylan and there's Seeger.
Well, and yeah, Seeger is remembered as the conservative, and that's unfair. I mean, this is, you know, the thing that nobody seems to remember is, you know, this, and again, you know, here we're talking about something that I had the same dumb reaction. I mean, Johnny Cash gets on stage at Newport in 64, wasn't there in 65, despite the movie, and refers to Bob Dylan in adulatory terms, and then says a sentence, I think he's the best folk songwriter or songwriter we've had since Pete Seeger. And my immediate reaction was, what? Pete Seeger wasn't a major songwriter. What? That's a bizarre comment. But no, it's not. If you were hearing the folk scene by what got on the charts, Pete Seeger was the guy who'd written Kisses Sweeter Than Wine, which had been a top 40 hit a couple of years earlier. He was the guy who'd written If I Had a Hammer, which had been the breakthrough hit for Peter, Paul, and Mary before they did Blowing in the Wind, and a rock hit for Trini Lopez. He was the guy who'd written Where Have All the Flowers Gone? He was the guy who'd done Turn, Turn, Turn. If you were listening to folk music as it got on the radio, which is, I'm sure, how Johnny Cash was primarily listening to folk music, Pete Seeger was absolutely the top songwriter on the folk scene before Dylan came along. And, you know, that's the sort of thing that's been completely, you know, I mean, it's one of the funniest mistakes. I think the funniest mistake in the movie is that moment where Dylan and the Susie Rotolo character are talking about, you know, how he should do his own songs. And she's like, yeah, you can't just keep singing old stuff like Where Have All the Flowers Gone, which was at that point a year old, 2 years old,
Right.
and written by Pete Seeger. I mean, the extent to which he was very much not the, I mean, the number of people who were alive at that time and describe the scene as, oh yeah, you couldn't write folk songs in those days. That was completely frowned upon. You had to actually sing the old stuff. You know, that was the whole Pete Seeger. Pete Seeger was putting out albums of current songwriters before Dylan arrived on the scene. Pete Seeger was the guy who started Broadside Magazine. I mean, the idea and the people who are saying, oh yeah, but you could, of course, you could write some folk songs if they were like union songs, but you couldn't write love songs. Kisses Sweeter Than Wine? You know, just he has been turned into this cartoon character. That was not at all who he was.
Right. Yeah, I think one of my biggest goals with the podcast has been to show all the sides of Pete Seeger. I think people want to see Pete Seeger in the way that's comfortable for them, with many of the old cliches. But that's always bothered me. Like, Pete Seeger is more than Where Have All the Flowers Gone is great. Turn, Turn, Turn is great. Waist Deeper Than Big Money is great. These are all important songs, but that isn't all Pete Seeger was. He didn't just sing three or four songs and become well known.
Yeah,
You know,
sure.
he did so many other things. Musically and culturally, that people ignore, and especially with the Blacklist, I think people really want to ignore the Blacklist and what it means in relation to the music. They don't want to talk about it. They want to talk about Selma and they want to talk about We Shall Overcome. They don't want to talk about the Blacklist. I find that to be particularly frustrating.
You know, on the other hand, I agree with you about a lot of that. You know, Pete Seeger was incredibly varied. And as I said at the beginning, I mean, he had an intense understanding also of his own limitations. I mean, he understood that, for example, I mean, I used in my book his comment on Michael Row the Boat Ashore and him saying, you know, I forget exactly the term, but basically how sappy it sounds as a summer camp song. And realizing that, yeah, that was his fault. That, you know, that his version of it had been pretty, you know, that, I mean, those records he did with the, what was it called? The song, the group with Mary Travers in it, that did several albums, you know, that he got together his basically youth chorus in 56 or 57. And I mean, those records are lousy. They were created to serve a purpose. They were created to make a bunch of young white urban kids feel like they could get together and sing this stuff. And they were completely successful in that. And there's no reason any human being on earth would want to hear the record of that experience. But he was creating that experience. And I mean, the thing I think that's most important to understand about Pete Seeger's records of the 1950s was that from, I forget the exact years, 54 to 60, he recorded, averaged 8 LPs a year. I mean, he was the folk scene. In every aspect of the folk scene came out of Pete Seeger, be it the New Lost City Ramblers, be it the summer camps, be it the topical songwriters. All of those strains came out of Pete. And, you know, he spread himself very thin. And I think it had a negative effect on his quote art, unless we understand his art to have been that, which is how I understand. I mean, I understand Pete's real art to have been what I believe he felt was his real art, which was to be a catalyst. And he had the talent to do other things, but he chose to be a catalyst rather than to be the hero. He was always happiest as part of a group, be that group the Weavers, be that group the organizers of the Newport Folk Festival, be that group the crew of the Clearwater, or be that group all those people singing with him at every goddamn concert. He, in fact, in all of those situations, was the unique leader without which that could not have happened. But he liked to perform the role of the catalyst who maybe was an, you know, the keystone, let's say, the stone without which the building could not be built, but just one more stone.
Right. Well, the link in the chain philosophy that he always talked about, and he felt a calling to it because I think he really felt like, well, if I don't do this, then where is the conduit? Where is the connection? Not that he is solely responsible, but like with Leadbelly and Woody Guthrie, like Woody's in the hospital, Leadbelly's dead. Pete has to be, he sees himself as someone who has to be a voice for these people that combined old and new traditions together, and he wants to pass that on. I mean, if it hadn't been Pete Seeger, who else would have done that?
I think you made a leap there that he wouldn't make. And I tend to agree with you, but I don't think Pete ever saw himself as, if I hadn't been there, it wouldn't have happened. I think Pete always saw himself as, I did my best, and had I not been there, there would have been others. I'm not sure that's true. And certainly it would have happened very differently without him. But I mean, Pete was a true communist, small c, not at times capital C, but at all times small c. I mean, he, you know, he was intensely committed. Many people would say at times annoyingly committed. But I mean, the story I, you know, my personal story that I always tell is the story of being at that Songs of Freedom and Struggle weekend retreat up the Hudson in the 1980s. And, you know, watching all this was a group that was committed to nurturing political songs and songwriters and song performers. And I was briefly involved and went to a weekend retreat up the Hudson. And there were all these There were some very, very decent, very, very committed activists. And they were also people who, I'm sorry, were pompous asses, who were sitting around with the young people at their feet, lecturing them on how to be a political folk singer. And Pete showed up at lunch on the second day and was asked to say a few words. And as I remember his entire speech, it went, this is a wonderful gathering. I'm really sorry that I can't be with you all weekend, but I can only be here for a couple hours. So if you want to talk with me, I'll be back in the kitchen doing the dishes. I mean, he knew exactly what he was doing. I'm not saying that that was him being modest and self-effacing. That was him modeling how you are a lead, how you should be a leader in that situation. And it was absolutely brilliant.
Well, one thing I'm curious to get your take on, and you may not like this question, you don't have to answer it, but today there is, of course, a huge Dylan following online in these social media communities. And it's not just the 60s Dylan, it's the contemporary Dylan.
Absolutely.
That's all very exciting. And I'm a Dylan fan. I'm not clearly, down as far as these people in terms of talking about everything Dylan's currently doing. I've always been a Dylan fan, but one thing that I've observed in the three dozen Dylan podcasts that there are, and I can't keep track of all of them and what everybody is saying, but many of these self-proclaimed Dylanologists, they've taken up this label and they're owning this label and reclaiming it for themselves. Many of them have not acknowledged your work very much, and I'm curious, what do you think? Do you know why this is? Even after the movie comes out, your book has been minorly discussed, in my opinion. It has been acknowledged a little bit since, but it's not been part of the zeitgeist when other things are, right? Like Clinton Halen is still probably talked about more than you. But I think you have a critical edge
Well, a
that isn't acknowledged.
couple of responses. First of all, Clinton Halen has devoted his life to this, and I have not. I have no resentment whatsoever to Clinton Halen having a higher rank among the Dylanologists than I have. He has, he's devoted his life to it. The second thing I'd say is, Dylan has been making records for 63 years now, and I've written about 4 years of that. That's, to me, the most interesting part of Dylan's career. But for people who have followed his entire career, it's a tiny, tiny piece of his career. And there are many, many people who think that Dylan's greatest work starts with Blood on the, not starts with, but there are many people who consider Blood on the Tracks his greatest album. And there are many people who might name any number of later albums as their favorite Dylan album. I know people who'll name Oh Mercy as their favorite Dylan album. I am someone who has never heard Oh Mercy. I'm sure I've heard tracks off it, but I've never owned a copy. I've never listened to it. So the fact that people who are serious Dylan fans don't see me as one of them, I don't resent in the least. I mean, I am very interested in a certain period. Dylan was an incredibly important artist for me personally in that period, which was my formative period. But there are many, 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 many people who are much deeper into his work than I am. And I don't see any reason why a Dylan fan or a Dylan website or podcast or Dylan himself should particularly care for the period up to age 24. Now, having said that, obviously I am pleased that Dylan himself does think of that period sort of the way I do. I mean, when I read Chronicles and then saw the interviews he was doing, yes, I was pleased to find Dylan saying he had a magic back through Blonde on Blonde that he lost. And since then has been trying to make it up as a craftsman. And when interviewers said, well, what about Blood on the Tracks? He'd say, nah, I was, that was me really coming back and mastering my craft. But it was no longer hitting, falling on me like lightning from above the way it was. When he talks about there was a period when I was getting these incredible lines that I've never got since. He starts quoting, "It's all right, Ma, not Idiot Wind." I mean, he apparently feels rather the way I feel about it, which is that, the magical Dylan period was that first period. But there have been a lot of other Dylan periods since then. And a lot of really strong Dylan periods. And there is no other artist of his generation who has kept being creative in new and interesting ways for anything resembling as long as he has. I mean, the last time I saw him was probably 7 years ago. And he startled me the way, I mean, he startled me at that point by the fact that I was not particularly interested or excited by his Sinatra album. But God damn it, he went on stage and absolutely the high point of that concert was the standards, and they were unbelievably well chosen. He was doing old man songs. I mean, he was doing Autumn Leaves, September of My Years, September Song in that creaky voice. But his phrasing was brilliant. His pitch was perfect. I was there with my wife, who is not a fan of that sort of thing. She's a jazz clarinet player. And she was astonished. I mean, it was really good in ways that he could never have pulled off in his youth. I mean, he has continued to grow as an artist in ways that are unprecedented. I can't think of anyone comparable. So the fact that other people are not caught up in this little period that for me is the magic period, that's fine.
Well,
God knows if I'm not going to complain about being overlooked. I mean, come on. There are a million goddamn Dylan books, and mine was the one that got made into a movie. I am the opposite of overlooked.
no, I just mean if one were to do a lit review of Dylan, and in terms of critical analytical approaches, I mean, yours is one which goes in a different direction.
Yeah,
And
I would say, but I would say generally speaking, when people do a, 10 important Dylan books roundup, I tend to be on it. Not always, but pretty frequently. And there are hundreds of Dylan books. I mean, and as I say, I mean, Clinton has devoted so much energy to this. Greil Marcus has done how many Dylan books by now? I did one in 6 months among, as you have pointed out, a lot of other books, many of which I put more time into. I mean, that in some ways is wrong because in some ways I had put my life into the scene that I was writing about in that Dylan book. I mean, the researching and writing of the specific book took 6 months and the 40 years of my life previous to that. I mean, I do feel like there are things about that scene I understand in ways that Clinton Halen and Greil Marcus never will. Because I grew up in it and I'm a player. But I would balance that by saying there's a hell of a lot of stuff about Dylan and all sorts of other things that they understand that I won't.
Well, that leads me to ask you, I have maybe two or three more questions. One is, do you have a favorite Dylan song and a favorite Seeger song? What are they?
No. Both of them have done so much and so varied work that what I want to listen to in a particular mood is, that varies. I mean, I think like lots of other people, I would say Highway 61 is far and away my favorite, the masterpiece of Dylan albums. But I will, but there are times I'd rather listen to the first album. There are times I'd rather listen to Freewheeling. There are times I'd rather listen to Another Side Of. There are times I'd rather listen to Blonde on Blonde, not to Blonde on Blonde. Well, there are moments for Blonde on Blonde, to Bring It All Back Home. There's no time I'd rather listen to the times they are changing, but it was important in its moment. But like that. Seeger, it's way beyond that. I mean, Seeger, when he wrote up his own review of him, he finished it by saying, if you go through all his albums and assemble the best of tape, you could compile one really great Pete Seeger album. But everyone would make different choices. Therein lies his defense. And that's right. And, and for me, I could compile several Seeger albums that I loved. There is, if I have to pick one performance that I tend to play for people, it's that version of Blue Skies, just because it blows people's minds. Because they don't think of him as a guy who A would choose to do that, or B would do it so brilliantly. But I mean, if I went back right now, I mean, I haven't listened to a Pete Seeger album probably in 30 years, but I still have a lot of Pete Seeger albums. That isn't true because I must have listened to the Darling Corey album when I wrote the Dylan book, and I listened to the We Shall Overcome live concert, which was finally out on CD when I did the Dylan book. But if I went back and listened again, it would be impossible for me to separate what I loved because I loved it and what I loved because it reminded me of when I was 8 years old listening to it. I mean, right now, as we have this conversation, I want to go down and listen to Monongahela Sal. I loved that. And I haven't heard it in years, and I would go back and listen to that. But I mean, there's so many. Yeah, I mean, he did so much work. It is that stuff. Again, I mean, it's not, he wasn't that good a songwriter. I mean, I just, on my blog, I recently did Last Train to Nuremberg. And I left out one verse on purpose because I thought it was lousy. And then went back and looked and found there was another verse that I'd forgotten about completely. I think it's conceptually a very powerful song, but it has some clunky verses. And I don't think and again, I don't think he would disagree.
Well, earlier in our conversation, talked about Dylan and Seeger being two people that were frequently not in the same room together, and that is entirely true. I mean, he tells David Dunaway in his interviews that I only saw Bob like twice a year for a few years. It was infrequent. And we have these diverging discourses about them, but how should we be thinking about these two musicians respectively today, one together and by themselves? How should we look at these two guys?
Well, I'm not going to tell anybody else how they should look at anything, but I mean, as I said at the beginning, I think Seeger's going to be forgotten, or remembered tangentially for his influence. I I do not think that Seeger's art has been preserved. I think Seeger was, as I said at the beginning, I mean, I think Seeger was a live performer and a catalyst. I think Seeger, in a way, his dream came true, which was to be the font of all sorts of things. I mean, the world of music would be completely different without Pete Seeger. And many of the people who I would say are most, to me, descendants of Pete Seeger may never have listened to him. I mean, his influence permeates not just the music, but the way people think about music. I mean, I was just reading a New Yorker piece on Phish, and I can't help but thinking their whole approach, in some ways, not to their music, but to remaining completely outside of the commercial world and just creating this communal thing and bringing up the musicians they love to play. And, you know, it's so Seegery. And in a way that I don't think would have existed without him. I don't think Woodstock would have existed without him. I mean, the list of things that would not have existed without him is huge. You know, he always put his own work second to that bigger project, and that's where it is. Dylan, I have no idea how he'll be remembered. But the difference with Dylan is the work is there on the records, and the records are going to be there. And, you know, different people love different periods. And there are people for whom, you know, every period has produced work that I think stands the test of time. And, you know, the fact that if I go to a Dylan concert right now, I don't know what I'm going to hear. And most of the audience will be significantly younger than me. You know, that's an amazing feat. And the fact that people who consider themselves huge Dylan fans, if I play them freewheeling, will say, "Who's that?" Because that voice is not familiar to them, because he hasn't sounded like that in so long. That's amazing. I mean, you know, there's no Rolling Stones fan who I can play them early Rolling Stones and they'll go, "Who's that? It doesn't sound like the Rolling Stones." No, I mean, they're very, very different artists, and they understood each other's strengths, I think, profoundly. I mean, I quote Dylan in the book saying, you know, Pete Seeger was like some kind of shaman. You know, he created this communal, I don't, you can say spiritual in a way, experience. And he says rock stars aren't like that. You know, he says we're just, you know, we may be going out, you know, living out people's fantasies on stage. That Pete created something deeper than that. And I think that's right. But again, will people remember that? Well, you know, you're trying to make sure that they will. God bless you. You're doing God's work.
Yeah. Did the film help you accomplish further what you were trying to accomplish with the book?
I think it's a good book. You know, I like my books. That's why I write them. There are books that I wish had received more attention than they have received. This one I feel extremely lucky for the amount of attention it has received. It's funny to me that you suggested that it has been in some ways overlooked. I feel on the contrary, that I wrote one Dylan book and it has received inordinate attention. I think it's a good book, but what the hell? I mean, if people ask me what one Dylan book should I read, I, you know, I'm gonna, demonstrate my, you could say my age, my interests. I'm going to say the Scaduto biography still is my favorite Dylan book. And by now, when I see lists of the top Dylan, 10 Dylan books to read, they rarely include the Scaduto biography, which is the only Dylan book ever written with Dylan's input. You know, if I were going to pick an underappreciated Dylan book, it ain't mine. It's that one. And
Elijah.
I wish someone would write a great Dylan book, a great Seeger book, by the way. I mean, I'm not going to do it. Peter Guralnick keeps urging me to, but I'm not going to do it. Because honestly, you know, I wrote a Dylan book when I found a Dylan book I could write that would end in 1965. Seeger, I don't know where you'd end a Seeger book. But if you and if you're going to do the entire sweep of his life, that's a hell of a project because it was a long and very rich life.
Indeed. Well, Elijah, we'll end our conversation here. Thank you so
Sure.
much for being part of the podcast. It's been great.
Thank you.
Thank you, everyone, for joining us for this episode. It was great to have an expert like Elijah on the show. Hope you enjoyed that. I know I did. Just a couple of comments about some of Elijah's insights. I wanted to mention, I really think he puts his finger right on the problem of how and why Pete's legacy has not been well maintained, at least not like Dylan's or not like Guthrie's. Being because Pete was a phenomenon, like Elijah says, where he was a live performer. And a Seeger concert was not like other folk concerts. It's hard to learn about him and his message through his Folkways records or his Columbia records alone. And as you heard, I emphasize the significance of those with Elijah, at least in my opinion, but I think you do already have to be in a certain place in life or in the world to get the politics or to get the meaning or feeling from those records. And I think Elijah is right that Pete recorded in the studio just can't create that same atmosphere. It's harder for younger listeners to understand him or know anything about him because the records can't maintain that legacy in the same way. It's a challenge. I never really thought about how deeply, like, Woody Guthrie is easier to listen to on the record than Pete Seeger. For those in it, it's hard to notice, maybe. There are differences, but it's hard to tease it out if you're so close to it. Something we didn't discuss, for example, is perhaps how Woody's symbolism endures in a way that Pete's doesn't. And maybe that has to do with the records, and maybe that's part of just the whole challenge of this as well, something that I want to continue thinking about. And hopefully this podcast will continue to consider these questions and further explore how to navigate these issues. And perhaps the movie will do this as well. Only time will tell, I think. If you're wondering about the World Trip episode, it is still in the works. As I've mentioned before, it's such an under-researched topic, and I want to do it justice, so hopefully this autumn it will be out. I want to keep things chronological with the content episodes just for the purposes of flow, and eventually we will talk about Newport and Rainbow Quest and the Smothers Brothers eventually, which I'm sure everyone wants to hear about, but remember, the purpose of the podcast is to uncover all the important pieces, not just the highlights people already know about. So we'll all just have to be patient about that. In any event, thank you for listening. If you're just joining us, welcome. Please consider joining the Patreon and contributing $1 or $3 a month to help with the distribution and other technological expenses and travel. Anything you can contribute helps us keep the podcast out there for us all. Is a Season, the Pete Seeger podcast, is written, recorded, and produced by Adam C. Morse.
See you all next time. Thank you.